rode east of Nykvarn. For the first time in his life he had been beaten in a fight, and the one who had dished out the punishment was Paolo Roberto, the boxer. It felt like an absurd dream, the kind he might have on a restless night. He could not understand where the boxer had come from. Out of the blue he was just there, standing inside the warehouse. It made no sense. He had not even felt the punches. That did not surprise him, but he had felt the kick in the balls, and that terrific thump on the head had made him black out. Gingerly he explored the back of his neck and touched an enormous lump. He pressed with his fingers, but he sensed no pain. And yet he felt groggy. He had lost a tooth on the left side of his upper jaw. His mouth was full of the taste of blood. He held his nose between his thumb and forefinger and bent it experimentally upwards. He heard a snapping sound inside his head and could tell that his nose was broken. He had done the right thing in taking his bag and leaving the warehouse before the police could get there, but he had made a colossal mistake. On the Discovery Channel he had seen how crime scene investigators could find any amount of forensic evidence. Blood, hair, DNA. He didn't have the slightest desire to return to the warehouse, but he had no choice. He had to clean up. He made a U-turn and started back. Just before Nykvarn, he passed a car coming the other way. But he thought no more about it. The trip back to Stockholm was a nightmare. Paolo Roberto had blood in his eyes and was so beaten up that his whole body hurt. He was driving like a drunk, weaving all over the road. He wiped his eyes with one hand and tentatively felt his nose. It really hurt, but he had to breathe through his mouth. He kept looking out for a white Volvo and thought he saw one pass going the other way near Nykvarn. When he got on the E20, the driving was a little easier. He thought about stopping in Södertälje, but he had no idea where to go. He glanced back at the girl, still in handcuffs, lying on the back seat without a seatbelt. He had had to carry her to the car, and as soon as she landed on the seat she went out like a light. He didn't know if she had fainted from her wounds or shut down out of sheer exhaustion. He hesitated, then turned onto the E4 and headed for Stockholm. Blomqvist had slept only an hour before the telephone started ringing. He squinted at the clock and saw that it was just past 4 a.m. He reached groggily for the receiver. It was Berger, and at first he could not understand what she was saying.
"Paolo Roberto is where?"
"At the hospital in Cerda with the woo girl. He tried to reach you, but you weren't answering."
"I turned my mobile off." "What the hell is he doing in the hospital?"
Berger's voice sounded patient, but determined.
"Mika, get a taxi over there right away and find out." He sounded totally confused and was talking about a chainsaw and some building out in the woods and a monster who couldn't box.
Blomqvist blinked himself awake. Then he shook his head and made for the shower. Paolo Roberto looked miserable lying there in his shorts on the hospital bed. Blomqvist had waited an hour to be allowed to see him. His nose was hidden beneath a bandage. His left eye was covered too, and one eyebrow had surgical tape over 5 stitches. He had a bandage wrapped round his chest and cuts and bruises all over his body. His right knee was in a brace. Blomqvist offered him a coffee from the machine in the hall and inspected his face critically.
"You look like a car crash," he said.
"Tell me what happened." Paolo Roberto shook his head and met Blomqvist's gaze.
"A fucking monster happened," he said.
He shook his head again and inspected his fists. His knuckles were so swollen that he could scarcely hold the cup. His right hand and wrist were in a splint. His girlfriend already had a lukewarm attitude towards boxing. Now she was going to be furious.
"I'm a boxer," he said. "I mean, when I was active, I wasn't afraid to step into the ring with anybody. I've taken a punch or two, but I know how to dish 'em out, too. When I punch somebody, they're supposed to sit down and hurt."
But this one didn't do that. Paolo Roberto shook his head for the third time. Then he told Blomqvist what had happened during the night.
"I hit him at least 30 times. 14 or 15 times to the head. I hit him on the jaw 4 times. At first I was holding back a bit. I didn't want to kill him, just protect myself. But in the end I gave it everything I had. One of my punches should have broken his jaw, but that fucking monster just shook his head a little and kept on coming. That is not a normal human being, I swear to God.
What did he look like?
He was built like a tank, I'm not exaggerating. He was over 6'6" and weighed at least 300 pounds. All muscle and armour plating. A fucking giant who doesn't know what pain is.
You've never seen him before?
Never. He had no idea how to box. I could faint and throw him off his guard, and he didn't have a clue how to move to avoid being hit. He was out of it. But at the same time, he tried to move like a boxer. He held his arms up the right way, and he kept recovering to a starting stance. Maybe he'd trained in boxing, but hadn't heard a word of what the trainer said. What saved my life, and the girl's, was that he moved so slowly. He would throw roundhouse swings that he telegraphed a month in advance, and I could duck or parry them. He got in 2 good punches on me, one to the face, and you see what that did, then one to the body, where he cracked a rib, but neither of them was full power. If he'd landed them properly, he would have knocked my head off.
Paolo Roberto laughed, a bubbling sort of laugh. What's funny?
I won. That moron tried to kill me, and I won. I actually decked him, but I had to use a fucking plank to get him down for the count.
He turned serious again.
If Miriam Wu hadn't kicked him in the balls at just the right moment, I don't want to think about how the hell it would have ended.
Paolo, I'm really, really glad you won. Miriam is going to say the same thing when she wakes up. Have you heard how she's doing?
She looks about the same as I do. She has a concussion, several cracked ribs, a broken nose and damaged her kidneys.
Bloomquist bent forward and put his hand on Paolo Roberto's good knee. If you ever need me to do anything, he said. Paolo Roberto smiled.
Bloomquist, if you ever need a favour again...
Yes?
Ask Sebastian Lujan to do it for you.
Chapter 26 Wednesday, April 6th. Inspector Boblanski was in a dismal mood when he met Murdig in the parking lot outside the hospital just before 7. Bloomquist had woken him up, and he in turn called Murdig and woke her up. They met Bloomquist by the entrance and went with him to Paolo Roberto's room. Boblanski could hardly grasp the bewildering details, but what was eventually clear was that Wu had been kidnapped, and that the boxer had beaten up the kidnapper. Except that, to judge by his face, it was far from obvious who had beaten up whom. As far as Boblanski was concerned, the night's events had lifted the investigation of Lisbeth Salander to a whole new level of complication. Nothing in this infernal case seemed to be normal. How had Paolo Roberto even gotten involved in the affair?
"I'm a good friend of Lisbeth Salander's," he told them.
Boblanski and Murdig looked at each other, surprised and sceptical.
"She sparred with me at the gym."
Boblanski fixed his gaze somewhere on the wall behind Paolo Roberto. Murdig could not help laughing out loud. After a while, they had written down all the details he could give them. "I'd like to make a few points," Bloomquist said dryly. They turned to him. "First of all, Paolo's description of the man who drove away from the warehouse in the van matches the one I gave of the person who attacked Salander at the same spot on Lundegarten. A tall guy with a light brown ponytail and a beer belly. Okay?" Boblanski nodded. "Second, the point of the kidnapping was to force Miriam Wu to reveal where Lisbeth Salander is hiding. So these two thugs have been looking for Salander since at least a week before the murders. Agreed?" Murdig murmured a yes. "Third, it looks less likely that Salander is the lone nutcase she has been portrayed as. And neither of these maniacs seems, on the face of it, to be a member of a lesbian Satanist gang." Neither Boblanski nor Murdig said a word. "And finally, number 4. I think this story has something to do with a man called Zala. Dag Svensson did a lot of work on him in his last 2 weeks. All the relevant information is in his computer. Dag linked him to the murder of a prostitute named Irina Petrova in Suratalia. The autopsy recorded that she was very severely beaten, so severely that any one of 3 of the worst blows would have been fatal on its own. Her injuries sound very like the ones that Miriam Wu and Paolo Roberto have been subjected to. In both cases, the instruments of this extraordinary violence could be the hands of a gigantic thug."
"And Bierman?"
Boblanski said.
Let's suppose that someone had a reason to silence Svensson. Who would have had a motive to murder Salander's guardian?
All the pieces of the puzzle aren't in place yet, but there's a connection between Bjurman and Zala. That's the only credible solution. Could you agree to start thinking along new lines? I think that these crimes have something to do with a sex trade, and Salander would sooner die than be involved in something like that. I told you, she's a damned moralist.
So what was her role? What was she doing at Svensson and Johansson's apartment?
I don't know. Witness? Opponent? Maybe she was there to warn Dag and Mia that their lives were in danger. Boblanski set the wheels in motion. He called the Södertälje police and gave them Paolo Roberto's directions to a dilapidated warehouse southwest of Lake Ingern. Then he called Holmberg. He lived in Flemingsberg and was closest of the team to Södertälje, and asked him to join up with the Södertälje police as soon as he possibly could to assist with the crime scene investigation. Holmberg called back an hour later. He had arrived at the crime scene. The Södertälje police had had no difficulty finding the warehouse. Along with two smaller storage sheds, it had burned to the ground, and the fire department was there now mopping up. There were two discarded gasoline cans in the yard. Boblanski felt a sense of frustration approaching fury. What the hell was going on? Who were these thugs? Who was this Salander person, really? And why was it impossible to find her? The situation did not improve when Ekström joined the fray at the 9 o'clock meeting. Boblanski told him about the morning's dramatic developments and proposed that the search be reprioritized in light of the mysterious events that had taken place, which cast doubt on the scenario that the team had been working on. Paolo Roberto's story reinforced Blomqvist's account of the attack on Salander on Lundegarten. The hypothesis that all three murders were committed by one mentally ill woman no longer seemed valid. The suspicions regarding Salander could not altogether be discarded. They needed an explanation for her fingerprints being on the murder weapon, but it did mean that the investigation had to work on the possibility of a different killer. There was only one theory at present, Blomqvist's belief that the murders had to do with Svensson's imminent exposé of the sex trade. Boblanski identified three significant points. The prime task was to find and identify the abnormally large man and his associate with the ponytail who had kidnapped and assaulted Miriam Wu. The giant should be relatively easy to find. Anderson reminded them that Salander also had an unusual appearance and that after 3 weeks of searching the police still had no idea where she was. The second task was to add to the investigative team a group that would actively focus on the list of prostitutes' clients in Svensson's computer. There was a logistical problem associated with this. The team had Svensson's computer from Millennium and the zip disks that held the backup of his missing laptop, but they contained several years' worth of collected research and thousands of pages. It would take time to catalogue and study them. The team needed reinforcements, and Boblanski detailed Murdoch to head that unit. The third task was to focus on a person who went by the name of Zala. The team would enlist the assistance of the National Criminal Investigation Department, since they apparently had come across the name. He assigned that task to Faster. Finally, Anderson was to coordinate the continued search for Salander. Boblanski's report took 6 minutes, but it touched off an hour-long dispute. Faster was vociferous in his resistance to Boblanski's proposals, and he made no attempt to conceal this. His opinion was that the investigation, regardless of the new peripheral, he called it, information, had to stay focused on Salander. The chain of evidence was so strong that it was unreasonable to divide the effort into different channels.
"This is all bullshit. We have a violence-prone nutcase who has grown worse and worse over the years. Do you actually believe that all the psychiatric reports and results from forensics are a joke? She's tied to the crime scene. We know she's a hooker, and there's a large sum of money unaccounted for in her bank account. I'm aware of all that. She's also a member of some sort of lesbian sex cult, and I'll be damned if that dyke Sillenoren doesn't know more than she's letting on."
Boblanski raised his voice.
"Faster, stop it. You're totally obsessed with this gay angle. It's way past professional."
He at once regretted speaking out in front of the whole group. A private talk with Faster would have been more productive. Finally, Ekström interrupted the raised voices to approve Boblanski's plan of action. Boblanski glanced at Bormann and Hedström.
As I understand it, we only have you for 3 more days. So let's make the best of the situation. Bormann, can you help Anderson track down Salander? Hedström, you'll stay with Mudig.
Ekström raised his hand as they were about to break up.
One last thing. We're keeping the part about Paolo Roberto under our hats. The media will go ballistic if one more celebrity springs to light in this investigation. So not a word about it outside this room.
After the meeting, Mudig took Boblanski aside.
It was unprofessional of me to lose patience with Faster, Boblanski said.
I know how it feels, she said with a smile. I started on Svensson's computer last Monday.
I know. How far did you get?
He had 12 versions of the manuscript and a huge amount of research material, and I don't know yet what's important and what's safe to ignore. Just cataloguing it with meaningful names and looking through all the documents will take several days.
What about Hedström?
Mudig hesitated. Then she turned and closed Boblanski's door.
To tell you the truth, I don't want to trash him, but he isn't much help.
Boblanski frowned.
Out with it.
I don't know. He's obviously not a real policeman like Bormann. He talks a lot of drivel. He has about the same attitude towards Miriam Wu as Faster does, and he's totally uninterested in the assignment. And, although I can't put my finger on it, he has some kind of problem with Salander.
How so?
I've got a feeling there's some bad blood between them.
Boblanski nodded slowly.
That's a shame. Bowman's okay, but I don't really like having outsiders involved in this investigation.
So what shall we do?
You'll have to put up with him for the rest of the week. Armansky said they'll break it off if they don't get results. Keep digging and count on having to do the whole job yourself.
Mudig was interrupted after only 45 minutes. She was called to Ekström's office. Boblanski was with him. Both men were red in the face. Tony Scala, the freelance journalist, had just released a scoop with the news that Paolo Roberto had rescued the S&M dyke Miriam Wu from an unknown kidnapper. The article contained several details that could only be known to someone inside the investigation. It was written in such a way as to suggest that the police were considering filing charges against Paolo Roberto for assault. Ekström had already received several phone calls from other papers that wanted news about the boxer's role. He was livid. He accused Mudig of having leaked the story. Mudig vigorously objected to the accusation, but in vain. Ekström wanted her off the investigation.
"Sonia says she didn't leak anything," Boblanski said. "That's good enough for me. It's insane to remove an experienced detective who's familiar with every detail of the case."
Ekström refused to budge.
"Mudig, I can't prove that you leaked the information, but I have no confidence in you with regard to this investigation. You are relieved from the team, effective immediately. Take the rest of the week off. You'll be given other assignments on Monday."
Mudig nodded and headed for the door. Boblanski stopped her.
"Sonia, for the record, I don't believe one word of this, and you have my full confidence. But I'm not the one who decides. See me in my office before you go home, please."
Boblanski's face had taken on a dangerous hue. Ekström looked furious. Mudig went back to her office where she and Hedström had been working on Svensson's computer. She was angry and close to tears. Hedström could tell that something was wrong, but he said nothing, and she ignored him. She sat at her desk and stared into space. There was an oppressive silence in the room. After a while, Hedström excused himself and said he had to get a cup of coffee. He asked if he could bring her one. She shook her head. When he had left, she got up and put on her jacket. She took her shoulder bag and went to Boblanski's office. He pointed to the visitor's chair.
"Sonia, I don't intend to yield in this matter unless Ekström removes me from the investigation, too. I won't accept it, and I'm thinking of filing a complaint. Until you hear otherwise from me, you'll remain on my team, at my direction. Understand?"
She nodded.
"You will not take the rest of the week off, as Ekström said. I want you to go to Millennium's offices and have another talk with Blomqvist. Ask him for help in guiding you through Doug Svensson's hard drive. They have a copy there. We could save a lot of time if we have somebody who's already familiar with the material, picking out the things that might be important."
Murdig breathed more easily.
I didn't say anything to Hedstrom.
I'll take care of him. He can help Anderson. Have you seen Foster?
No. He left right after the meeting.
Boblansky sighed. Blomqvist had arrived home from the hospital at 8 a.m. He had had too little sleep, and he had to be at his best for an afternoon meeting with Björk at Smodalero. He undressed, set the alarm for 10:30, and got 2 more hours of much-needed sleep. He shaved, showered, and put on a clean shirt. As he was driving past Gullmarsplan, Murdig called his mobile. Blomqvist explained that he would not be able to meet her. She told him what she needed, and he referred her to Berger. When she arrived at Millennium's offices, Murdig found that she liked the self-confident and slightly domineering woman with the dimples and shock of short blonde hair. She vaguely wondered whether Berger was a dyke, too, since all the women in this investigation, according to Foster, seemed to have that inclination. But then she remembered that she had read somewhere that Berger was married to the artist Gregor Beckmann.
"There's a problem here," Berger said after listening to her request. "What's that?" "It's not that we don't want to solve the murders or help the police. Besides, you already have all the material in the computer you took from here. The dilemma is an ethical one. The media and the police don't work very well together."
"Believe me, I found that out this morning," Murdig said with a smile.
"How so?"
"Nothing. Just a personal reflection."
"Okay. To maintain their credibility, the media have to keep a clear distance from the authorities. Journalists who run to the police station and cooperate with police investigations will end up being errand boys for the police."
"I've met some of those," Murdig said.
"But the opposite can also be true. And the police end up running errands for certain newspapers."
Berger laughed.
"That's right. I'm afraid to say that at Millennium we simply can't afford to be associated with that sort of mercenary journalism. This isn't about you wanting to question any of Millennium's staff, which we would allow without hesitation, but about a formal request for us to assist actively in a police investigation by placing our journalistic material at your disposal."
Murdig nodded.
"There are 2 points of view on that," Berger said. "First, one of our journalists has been murdered, so we will help out all we can. But the second point is that there are some things we cannot and will not give to the police. All that has to do with our sources."
"I can be flexible. I can pledge to protect your sources."
"It's not a matter of your intent or our trust in you. It is that we never reveal a source, no matter what the circumstances."
"Understood."
"Then there's the fact that at Millennium we're conducting our own investigation into the murders, which should be viewed as a journalistic assignment. In this case, I'm prepared to hand over information to the police when we have something finished that we are ready to publish, but not before."
Berger frowned as she paused to think.
"I also have to be able to live with myself." "Let's do this. You can work with Malin Eriksson. She's familiar with the material and competent to decide where the boundaries lie. She'll guide you through Dag's book, with the objective of compiling a list of all those who might be suspects."
As she caught the shuttle train from Södra station to Södertälje, Irene Nessa was unaware of the drama that had occurred the night before. She was wearing a mid-length black leather jacket, dark pants, and a neat red sweater. She wore glasses that she had pushed up on her forehead. In Södertälje, she walked to the Strängnäs bus and bought a ticket to Stallarholmen. She got off the bus a little south of Stallarholmen just after 11 a.m. There were no buildings in sight. She visualized the map in her head. Lake Mälaren was a few miles to the northeast. It was summer cabin country with a scattering of year-round residences. Bjurman's property was about 2 miles from the bus stop. She took a swallow of water from her bottle and started walking. She got there about 45 minutes later. She began by making a tour of the area and studying the neighbouring houses. About 150 yards to the right, she saw the next cabin. Nobody was at home. To the left was a ravine. She passed 2 summer houses before she reached a group of cabins where she noticed signs of life, an open window and the sound of a radio. But that was 300 yards from Bjurman's cabin. She could work undisturbed. She had taken the keys from his apartment. Once inside, she first unscrewed a window shutter at the back of the house, giving her an escape route in case any unpleasantness should occur at the front. The unpleasantness she was prepared for was that some cop might get the idea to show up at the cabin. Bierman's was one of the older buildings, with one main room, one bedroom, and a small kitchen with running water. The toilet was a compost outhouse in the backyard. She spent 20 minutes looking through the closets, wardrobes, and dresses. She did not find so much as one scrap of paper that could have anything to do with Lisbeth Salander or Zala. Then she went and searched the outhouse and woodshed. She found nothing of interest and no paperwork at all. The journey had apparently been in vain. She sat on the porch and drank some water and ate an apple. When she went to close the shutter, she stopped short in the hallway as she caught sight of an aluminium stepladder 3 feet high. She went into the main room again and examined the clapboard ceiling. The opening to the attic was almost invisible between two roof beams. She got the stepladder, opened the trap door, and immediately found two A4 file boxes, each containing several folders and various other documents. Things had gone all wrong. One disaster had followed another. The blonde giant was worried. Sandström had gotten hold of the Rantas. They said he sounded terrified and reported that the journalist Svensson had been planning an exposé about his whoring activities and about the Rantas. So far it hadn't been a big deal. If the media exposed Sandström, it was none of his business, and the Ranta brothers could lie low for as long as they needed to. They had taken the Baltic Star to Estonia for a vacation. It was unlikely that the whole mess would lead to a court case, but if the worst should happen, they had done time before. It was part of the job description. More troublesome was that Salander had managed to elude Maga Lundin. This was incredible, since Salander was a rag doll compared to Lundin. All he had to do was stuff her in a car and take her to the warehouse south of Nykvarn. Then Sandström had received another visit, and this time Svensson was after Zala. That put everything in a whole new light. Between Bjurman's panic and Svensson's continued snooping, a potentially dangerous situation had arisen. An amateur is a gangster who is not prepared to take the consequences. Bjurman was a rank amateur. The giant had advised Zala not to have anything to do with Bjurman, but for Zala the name Lisbeth Salander had been irresistible. He loathed Salander. It was a reflex, like pressing a button. It was pure chance that he had been at Bjurman's place the night Svensson called. The same fucking journalist who had already caused problems for Sandström and the Rantas. He had gone to Bjurman's to calm him down, or to threaten him as needed after the abortive attempt to kidnap Salander. Svensson's call had triggered a wild panic in Bjurman, a reaction of unreasonable stupidity. All of a sudden, he wanted out. To top it off, Bjurman had fetched his cowboy pistol to threaten him. The giant had just looked at Bjurman in surprise and had taken the gun from him. He was already wearing gloves, so fingerprints weren't a problem. He had no choice. Bjurman had obviously flipped out. Bjurman knew about Zala, of course. That was why he was a liability. The giant couldn't really explain why he made Bjurman take off his clothes, except that he hated the lawyer and wanted to make that clear to him. He had almost lost it when he saw the tattoo on Bjurman's abdomen. "I am a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist." For a moment he almost felt sorry for the man. He was such a total idiot. But he was in a business where such feelings could not be allowed to interfere with what they had to do. So he had led Bjurman into the bedroom, forced him to his knees, and used a pillow as a silencer. He had spent 5 minutes searching through Bjurman's apartment for the slightest connection to Zala. The only thing he found was his own mobile number. To be on the safe side, he took Bjurman's mobile with him. Svensson was the next problem. When Bjurman was found dead, Svensson would inevitably call the police and tell them about his call to the lawyer to ask about Zala. Zala would then become the object of police interest. The blonde giant considered himself smart, but he had an enormous respect for Zala's almost uncanny strategic gifts. They had been working together for nearly 12 years. It had been a successful decade, and he looked up to Zala with reverence. He could listen for hours as Zala explained human nature and its weaknesses, and how one could profit from them. But quite unexpectedly, their business dealings were in trouble. He had driven straight from Bjurman's to Enschede and parked the white Volvo 2 streets away. As luck would have it, the front door of the building was not locked. He went up and rang the doorbell with the nameplate Svensson Johansson. He had fired 2 shots. There was a woman in the apartment, too. He didn't search the apartment or take any of their papers with him. He did take a computer that was on the table in the living room. He turned on his heel, went down the stairs and out to his car. His only mistake had been dropping the revolver on the stairs while he was trying to balance the laptop, and at the same time fish out his car keys. He stopped for a second, but the gun had skittered down the stairs to the basement, and he decided it would take too much time to go down and get it. He knew he was someone people would not forget having seen, so the important thing was to get out of there before anyone laid eyes on him. The dropped revolver had been at first a source of criticism, until Zala realized its implications. They were astonished when the police began a search for Salander. His mistake had turned into an incredible stroke of luck. It also created a new problem. Salander became the only remaining weak link. She had known Bjurman, and she knew Zala. She could put 2 and 2 together. When he and Zala conferred about the matter, they were in agreement. They had to find Salander and bury her somewhere. It would be ideal if she were never found. Then the murder investigation would eventually be shelved. They had taken a chance that Miriam Wu could lead them to Salander, and then everything had gone wrong again. Paolo Roberto. Of all people, out of nowhere. And according to the newspapers, he was also friends with Salander. The giant was dumbfounded. After Nykvarn, he had gone to Lundin's house in Svavelsjö, only 100 yards from the Svavelsjö MC's headquarters. Not an ideal hiding place, but he didn't have many options. He had to find somewhere to lie low until the bruises on his face began to fade and he could make himself scarce. He fingered his broken nose and felt a lump on his neck. The swelling had begun to subside. It had been a good move to go back and burn down the whole fucking place. Then, suddenly, he went ice cold.
Bjurman. He had met Bjurman once at his summer cabin, in early February, when Zala had accepted the job of taking care of Salander. Bjurman had had a file about Salander that he had leafed through. How could he have forgotten that? It could lead to Zala.
He went down to the kitchen and told Lundin to get himself to Stallarholmen as fast as he could, and start another fire. Boblanski spent his lunch break trying to put in order the investigation he knew was about to collapse. He spent time with Anderson and Bowman, who brought him up to date on the hunt for Salander. Tips had come in from Göteborg and Norrköping. Göteborg they ruled out right away, but the Norrköping sighting had potential. They informed their colleagues, and a cautious stakeout was put on an address where a girl who looked a little like Salander had been seen. He tried to find Faster, but he was not in the building and did not answer his mobile. After the stormy meeting, Faster had vanished. Boblanski then went to see Ekström to try to defuse the problem with Murdig. He set out all his reasons for thinking the decision to take her off the case was foolhardy. Ekström would not listen, and Boblanski decided to file a complaint after the weekend. It was an idiotic situation. Just after 3, he stepped into the corridor and saw Hedström coming out of Murdig's office, where he was still supposed to be combing through Svensson's hard drive. Boblanski thought it was now a meaningless exercise, since no real detective was looking over his shoulder to check what he might have missed. He decided that Hedström should be with Anderson for the rest of the week. Before he had a chance to say anything, Hedström disappeared into the toilet at the far end of the corridor. Boblanski went over to Murdig's empty office to wait for him to return. Then his eye fell on Hedström's mobile, which lay forgotten on the shelf behind his desk. Boblanski glanced at the door to the toilet, still closed. On pure impulse, he stepped into the office, stuffed Hedström's mobile into his pocket, walked rapidly back to his own office and closed the door. He clicked up the list of calls. At 9:57, 5 minutes after the morning meeting was over, Hedström had called a number with an 070 area code. Boblanski lifted the receiver of his desk telephone and dialed the number. Tony Scala answered. He hung up and stared at Hedström's mobile. Then he got up with an expression like a thundercloud. He had taken 2 steps towards the door when his telephone rang. He went back to pick it up and shouted his name into the receiver.
"It's Jerka. I'm back at the warehouse outside Nykvarn."
"What did you find?"
"The fire is out. We've been busy the last 2 hours. The Södertälje police brought a corpse-sniffing dog to check the area in case there was someone in the wreckage."
"Was there?"
"There was not. But we took a break, so the dog could rest his nose for a while. The handler says it's necessary, since the smells at an arson site are really strong.
Get to the point, Yerka. I'm a bit pressed here.
Well, he took a walk and let the dog loose away from the site of the fire. The dog signaled a spot about 75 yards into the woods behind the warehouse. We started digging. 10 minutes ago we found a human leg with a shoe. It seems to be a man's shoe. It was buried fairly shallow.
Oh, shit, Yerka. You've got to...
I've already taken command of the site and put a stop to the digging. I want to get forensics out here and proper checks before we proceed.
Very well done.
But that's not all. 5 minutes ago the dog marked another spot, some 80 yards from the first.
Salander had made coffee on Bjorman's stove and eaten another apple. She spent 2 hours reading through Bjorman's notes on her page by page. She was actually impressed. He had put quite a lot of effort into the task and systematized the information. He had found material about her that she didn't even know existed. She read Palmgren's journal with mixed feelings. It took up 2 black notebooks. He had started keeping a diary about her when she was 15. She had just run away from her 3rd set of foster parents, an elderly couple in Sigtuna. He was a sociologist, and she was an author of children's books. Salander had stayed with them for 12 days, and could tell that they were tremendously proud of making a social contribution by taking her in, and that they expected her constantly to express gratitude. She had finally had enough when her foster mother, boasting to a neighbour, started expounding about how important it was that someone took care of young people who had obvious problems. "I'm not a fucking social project," she wanted to scream. On the 12th day she stole 100 kroner from their food money and took the bus to Upplands Väsby and the shuttle train to Stockholm Central. The police found her 6 weeks later in the house of a 67-year-old man in Haninge. He had been an okay guy. He provided her with food and a place to live. She did not have to do much in return. He wanted to look at her when she was naked. He never touched her. She knew he would be considered a paedophile, but she had never felt the least threat from him. She thought him an introverted and socially handicapped person. She even came to experience a feeling of kinship when she thought about him. They were both outsiders. Someone had finally spotted her and called the police. A social worker did her best to persuade her to report the man for sexual assault. She had obstinately refused to say that anything untoward had occurred. And in any case, she was 15 and legal. Fuck you. Then Palmgren had intervened and signed for her. He started a diary in what appeared to be a frustrated attempt to allay and resolve his own doubts. The first entries were written in December 1993.
"Elle increasingly appears to be the most unmanageable young person I've ever had to deal with. The question is whether I'm doing the right thing when I oppose her return to St. Stephen's. She has now run away from 3 foster families in 3 months, and obviously risks coming to some harm during her excursions. I have to decide soon whether I should give up the assignment and request that she be put under the care of real experts. I don't know what's right and what's wrong. Today I had a serious talk with her."
Salander remembered every word of that serious talk. It was the day before Christmas Eve. Palmgren had taken her to his place and installed her in his spare room. He made spaghetti with meat sauce for supper, and then put her on the living room sofa and sat in an armchair across from her. She remembered wondering if Palmgren, too, wanted to see her naked. Instead, he spoke to her as if she were a grown-up. In fact, it had been a 2-hour monologue. She had hardly uttered a word. He had spelled out the realities, which were in effect, that now she had to decide between going back to St. Stephen's and living with a foster family. He would do what he could to find a family acceptable to her, and he insisted that she go with his choice. He had decided that she should spend the Christmas holidays with him, so she would have time to think about her future. It was up to her, but on the day after Christmas he wanted a clear answer and a promise from her that if she had problems she would turn to him instead of running away. Then he had sent her to bed and apparently sat down to write the first lines in his diary. The threat of being transported back to St. Stephen's frightened her more than Holger Palmgren could know. She spent an unhappy Christmas, suspiciously watching every move he made. The next day he still had not attempted to paw her, nor did he show any sign of wanting to sneak a look at her in the bath. On the contrary, he got really angry when she tried to provoke him by marching naked from his spare room to the bathroom. He had slammed the bathroom door hard. Later she had made him the promises he demanded. She had kept her word. Well, more or less. In his journal, Palmgren commented methodically on every meeting he had with her. Sometimes it was three lines, sometimes he filled several pages with his thoughts. Every so often she was surprised. Palmgren had been more insightful than she had imagined, and occasionally commented on incidents when she had tried to fool him, but he had seen through her. Then she opened the police report from 1991, and the pieces of the puzzle fell into place. She felt as if the ground had started to shake. She read the medical report written by Dr. Jesper H. Lödemann, in which Dr. Peter Teleborian figured prominently. Lödemann had been the prosecutor's trump card when he tried to get her institutionalized at the hearing when she was 18. Then she found an envelope containing correspondence between Teleborian and some policeman called Gunnar Björk. The letters were all dated 1991, just after all the evil happened. Nothing was said straight out in the correspondence, but suddenly a trap door opened beneath Salander. It took her several minutes to grasp the implications. Björk referred to some conversation they must have had. His wording was irreproachable, but between the lines he was saying that it would be all right with him if Salander were locked up in an asylum for the rest of her life.
"It is important for the child to get some distance from the context. I cannot evaluate her psychological condition or what sort of care she needs, but the longer she can be kept institutionalized, the less risk there is that she would unintentionally create problems regarding the current matter."
Regarding the current matter. Salander rolled the phrase around in her mind for a while. Teleborian was responsible for her care at St. Stephen's. It had been no accident. The tone of the correspondence led her to understand that these letters were never intended to see the light of day. Teleborian had known Björk. Salander bit her lower lip as she pondered. She had never done any research on Teleborian, but he had started out in forensic medicine, and even the security police occasionally needed to consult a forensic medical expert or psychiatrist for their investigations. If she started digging, she would surely find a connection. At some point during his career, Teleborian and Björk's paths had crossed. When Björk needed someone who could bury Salander, he had turned to Teleborian. That was how it had happened. What previously looked like chance now took on a whole new dimension. She sat still for a long time, staring into space. Nobody was innocent. There were only varying degrees of responsibility. And somebody was responsible for Salander. She would definitely have to pay a visit to Smodelro. She assumed that no one in the shipwreck that was the state justice system would have any desire to discuss the subject with her, and in the absence of anyone else, a talk with Gunnar Björk would have to do. She looked forward to that talk. She did not need to take all the folders with her. As she read them, they became forever imprinted on her photographic memory. She took along Palmgren's notebooks, Björk's police report from 1991, the medical report from 1996 when she was declared incompetent, and the correspondence between Teleborian and Björk. That was enough to fill her backpack. She closed the door, but before she had time to lock it, she heard the sound of motorcycles behind her. She looked around. It was too late to try to hide, and she didn't have the slightest chance of outrunning two bikers on Harley-Davidsons. She stepped down warily from the porch and met them in the driveway. Boblonsky marched furiously down the corridor and saw that Hedström had not yet returned to Murdig's office, but the toilet was vacant. He continued down the corridor and found him holding a plastic cup from the coffee vending machine, talking to Anderson and Bowman. Boblonsky turned unseen at the doorway and walked up one flight to Ekström's office. He shoved the door open without knocking, interrupting Ekström in the middle of a phone conversation.
"Come with me,"
he said.
"I beg your pardon?"
Ekström said.
"Put the telephone down and come with me."
Poblansky's expression was such that Ekström did as he was told. In this situation it was easy to understand why Poblansky had been given the nickname Officer Bubble. His face looked like a bright red anti-aircraft balloon. They went downstairs. Poblansky marched up to Hedström, took a firm grip on his hair, and turned him to Ekström.
"Hey, what the hell are you doing? Are you crazy?"
"Poblansky!"
Ekström shouted, startled. Hedström looked nervous. Bowman's mouth dropped open.
"Is this yours?"
Bublansky asked, holding out the Sony Ericsson mobile.
"Let me go!"
"Is this your mobile?"
"Yeah, damn it, let me go!"
"Not yet. You're under arrest."
"On what?"
"You're under arrest for breach of secrecy and for interfering with a police investigation. Or else give us a reasonable explanation for why, according to your list of calls, you called a journalist who answers to the name of Tony Scala at 9:57 this morning, right after the meeting and just before Scala went public with the very information we had decided to keep secret."
After getting instructions to go to Stallarholmen and set a fire, Lundin had wandered over to the clubhouse in the abandoned printing factory on the outskirts of Svavelsjö and taken Niemanen with him. It was perfect weather to roll out the hogs for the first time since winter. He had been given detailed directions and had studied a map. They put on their leathers and covered the distance from Svavelsjö to Stallarholmen in no time. Lundin did not believe his eyes when he saw Lisbeth Salander in the driveway in front of Bjurman's summer cabin. It was a bonus that would blow the giant's fucking mind. He was sure it was her, although she looked different. Was that a wig? She was just standing there, waiting for them. They rode up and parked, 6 feet away on each side of her. When they switched off their motors, it was utterly silent in the woods. Lundin didn't quite know what to say. At last he managed to speak.
"Well, how about that? We've been looking for you for a while, Salander. Sonny, meet Fröken Salander."
He smiled. Salander regarded Lundin with expressionless eyes. She noticed that he still had a bright red, newly healed welt on his cheek and jaw, where she had cut him with her keys. She raised her eyes and looked at the treetops behind him. Then she lowered them again. Her eyes were disconcertingly coal black.
"I've had a fucking miserable week, and I'm in a fucking bad mood," she said. "You know what the worst thing is? Every time I turn around, there's some fucking pile of shit with a beer belly in my way acting tough. Now I'd like to leave, so move your ass."
Lundin's mouth was hanging open. He thought he had heard wrong. Then he started laughing involuntarily. The situation was ridiculous. There stood a skinny girl who could fit into his breast pocket, getting cheeky with two fully grown men with leather vests that showed they belonged to Svavelsjö MC, which meant they were the most dangerous of bikers and would soon be members of Hell's Angels. They could tear her apart and stuff her in their saddlebags. Even if the girl was as nutty as a fruitcake, which she obviously was, according to the newspapers and what he had just seen of her here, their emblem still ought to command respect. And she didn't show the smallest sign of that. This sort of behaviour could not be tolerated. No matter how ridiculous the situation, he glanced at Niemanen.
"I think the dyke needs some cock, sonny," he said, climbing off the Harley and setting his kickstand.
He took two slow steps towards Salander and looked down at her. She did not shift an inch. Lundin shook his head and sighed. Then he lashed out a backhand with the same considerable power with which he had struck Blomqvist on Lundegarten. He met nothing but thin air. At the instant his hand should have hit her face, she took one step back and stood there just out of his reach. Niemanen was leaning on the handlebars of his Harley and watching his fellow club member with amusement. Lundin was red in the face and took another couple of swings at her. She backed up again. Lundin swung faster. Salander stopped abruptly and emptied half the contents of a mace canister in his face. His eyes burned like fire. The toe of her boot shot up with full force and was transformed into kinetic energy in his crotch with a pressure of about 1,700 pounds per square inch. Lundin dropped, gasping, to his knees and stayed there at a more comfortable height for Salander. She kicked him in the face, deliberately, as if she were taking a penalty in soccer. There was an ugly, crunching sound before Lundin toppled over like a sack of potatoes. It took a few seconds for Niemanen to realize that something unbelievable had happened before his eyes. He tried to set the kickstand of his Harley, missed, and had to look down. Then he decided to play it safe and started groping for the pistol he had in his vest's inside pocket. As he was pulling down the zipper, he caught a movement out of the corner of his eye. When he looked up, he saw Salander coming at him like a cannonball.
She jumped with both feet and kicked him full force in the hip, which didn't injure him, but was hard enough to knock over both him and his motorcycle. He narrowly missed having his leg pinned under the bike and stumbled a few paces backwards before he regained his balance. When he had her in view again, he saw her arm move, and a stone as big as his fist flew through the air. He ducked, and it missed his head by about an inch. He finally got out his pistol and tried to flick off the safety, but when he looked up again, Salander was upon him. He saw evil in her eyes, and felt, for the first time, a shocked terror.
"Good night," Salander said.
She shoved the taser into his crotch and fired off 50,000 volts, holding the electrodes against him for at least 20 seconds. Niemanen was transformed into a vegetable. Salander heard a noise behind her and spun around to see Lundin laboriously getting to his knees. She looked at him with raised eyebrows. He was fumbling blindly through the burning fog of the mace.
"I'm going to kill you," he roared.
He was groping around trying to locate Salander. She watched him circumspectly. Then he said,
"Fucking whore!"
Salander bent down and picked up Niemanen's pistol, noticing that it was a Polish P-83 Vanat. She opened the magazine and checked that it was loaded with the correct 9mm Makarov. She cocked it. She stepped over Niemanen and went across to Lundin, took aim with both hands, and shot him in the foot. He shrieked in shock and collapsed again. She wondered if she should bother asking about the identity of the Hulk she had seen with him at Bloomberg's cafe. According to Sandstrom, the man had murdered someone in a warehouse with Lundin's help. She should have waited to fire the pistol until she had asked her questions. Lundin did not seem to be in any condition now to carry on a lucid conversation, and there was the possibility that someone had heard the shot. So she ought to leave the area right away. She could always find Lundin at some later date and ask him the question under less stressful circumstances. She secured the weapon's safety, zipped it into her jacket pocket, and picked up her backpack. She had gone about 10 yards down the road when she stopped and turned around. She walked back slowly and studied Lundin's motorcycle.
"Harley Davidson," she said. "Sweet."
Chapter 27. Wednesday, April 6th. It was a beautiful spring day as Blomqvist drove Berger's car south towards Nienerswegen. Already there was a hint of green in the black fields, and there was real warmth in the air. It was perfect weather to forget all his problems and drive out for a few days to be at peace in his cabin in Sandhamn. He had agreed with Bjerk that he would be there at 1, but he arrived early and stopped in Dalarö to have coffee and read the papers. He did not prepare for the meeting. Bjerk had something to tell him, and Blomqvist was determined that this time he would come away from Smodelarö with concrete information about Zala. Bjerk met him in the driveway. He looked more self-assured, more pleased with himself than he had 2 days before. "What sort of move are you planning?" Blomqvist did not shake hands with him.
"I can give you information about Zala," Bjerk said. "But I have certain conditions."
"Let's hear them."
"I won't be named in Millennium's expose."
"Agreed."
Bjerk looked surprised. Blomqvist had accepted straight off, without argument, the point about which Bjerk was expecting to have a long negotiation. That was his only card. Information about the murders, in exchange for anonymity. Blomqvist had agreed and given up the chance of a strong headline in the magazine.
"I'm serious," Bjerk said, "and I want it in writing."
"You can have it in writing, but a document like that wouldn't be of any use to you. You've committed a crime that I know about, and which I'm bound to report to the police. But you know things, and you're using your position to buy my silence. I've thought about the matter, and I accept. I won't mention your name in Millennium. Either you take my word for it, or you don't."
While Bjerk thought about it, Blomqvist said, "I have some conditions, too. The price of my silence is that you tell me everything you know. If I discover that you're hiding something, our agreement is void, and I'll hang your name out to dry on every single news headline in Sweden, just as I did with Wennerström."
Bjerk shuddered at the memory.
"Okay," he said. "I don't have a choice.
I'll tell you who Zala is, but I'm going to need absolute confidentiality.
He reached out his hand. Blomqvist grasped it. He had just promised to assist in covering up a crime. But it didn't trouble him for a moment. All he had promised was that he himself and Millennium Magazine would not write about Björk. Svensson had already written the whole story in his book, and the book would be published. The call came through to the police in Strängnäs at 3:18 p.m. It came directly to the switchboard and not through the emergency services. A man named Ulberg, owner of a summer cabin just east of Stallaholmen, reported that he had heard what sounded like a shot, and went to see what was going on. He had found two severely wounded men. Well, one of the men may not have been so severely wounded, but he was in a lot of pain. And the cabin they were lying in front of was owned by Niels Bjurman, a lawyer. The late Niels Bjurman, that is. The man there was so much about in the papers. The Strängnäs police had already had an eventful day with an extensive traffic check in the community. During the course of the morning, the traffic assignment had been interrupted when a call came in that a middle-aged woman had been killed by her boyfriend at the house they shared in Finninge. At almost the same time, a fire had spread from an outhouse into a property in Storgardet. One body was found in the wreckage. And to top it all off, two cars had collided head-on on the Enköping Highway. Accordingly, the Strängnäs police force was busy, almost to a man. The duty officer, however, had been following the developments in Nykvarn that morning, and she deduced that this new commotion must have something to do with that Lisbeth Salander everyone was talking about, not least since Niels Bjurman was a part of the investigation. She took action on three fronts. She requisitioned the only remaining police van and drove directly to Stallaholmen. She called her colleagues in Södertälje and asked for assistance. The Södertälje force was also spread thin, since part of their manpower had been sent to dig up bodies around a burned-out warehouse south of Nykvarn. But the possible connection between Nykvarn and Stallaholmen prompted another duty officer in Södertälje to dispatch two cruisers to Stallaholmen to assist. In the end, the duty officer from Strängnäs called Inspector Bublanski in Stockholm. She reached him on his mobile. Bublanski was at Milton Security in a meeting with its CEO, Armanski, and two of his staff, Freklund and Bowman. Hedström was conspicuous by his absence. Bublanski immediately sent Andersson out to Bjurman's summer cabin and told him to take Fasta if he could get hold of him. After thinking for a moment, Bublanski also called Holmberg, who was near Nykvarn and therefore considerably closer to Stallaholmen. Holmberg had some news for him, too.
"We've identified the body in the pit."
"That's impossible. How so fast?"
"Everything's simple when the corpse considerately has himself buried with his wallet and laminated ID."
"Who is it?"
"A bit of a celebrity. Kenneth Gustafsson, known as the Vagabond. Does it ring a bell?"
"Are you kidding? Downtown hooligan, pusher, petty thief and addict? He's lying in a hole in Nykvarn?"
"Yes, that's the man. At least that's the ID in the wallet. Identification will have to be confirmed by forensics, and it's going to be like putting a puzzle together. The Vagabond was chopped into 5 or 6 pieces."
"Interesting. Paolo Roberto said that the super heavyweight he was fighting threatened Miriam Wu with a chainsaw."
"Could very well have been a chainsaw, but I haven't looked that closely. We've just started digging up the second site. They're busy setting up the tent."
"That's good, Jerka. It's been a long day, I know, but can you stay on this evening?"
"Sure, okay. I'll let them get on with it here and head on to Stallaholmen."
Bublanski disconnected and rubbed his eyes. The armed response team, hastily assembled from Strängnäs, arrived at Bjurman's summer cabin at 3:44 p.m. On the access road they literally collided with a man on a Harley-Davidson, who was wobbling along until he steered right into the oncoming van. It was not a serious collision. The police climbed out and identified Sonny Niemanen, 37 years old and a known killer from the mid-90s. Niemanen seemed to be in bad shape. When they put the cuffs on him, they were surprised to find that the back of his vest was slashed. A piece of leather, about 8 inches square, was missing. It looked peculiar. Niemanen was unwilling to discuss the matter. They locked him in the van and drove on 200 yards to the cabin. They found a retired harbour worker by the name of Oberg putting a splint on the foot of one Carl Magnus Lundin, 36 years old and president of the gang that called itself Svavelsjö MC.